The Optimist. Conversations with leaders and industries shaping Europe's future. Exploring the ideas and innovations driving progress across the continent.
Welcome to The Optimist, the Real Talk podcast with leaders who are shaping Europe's digital future. My name is Moritz Schönleber, I'm the Tech Community Lead. Today our moderator Dale Rickert is joined by Carla Husted, Director of the Center for Digital Society at the Mercator Foundation, and Kai Zenner, who is the Digital Policy Advisor in the European Parliament and Fellow of Practice at the TUM Think Tank. Together, as you will listen to, they'll talk about three themes: digital sovereignty, the balance between regulation and innovation, and finally, parenting. Little surprising, but of course not in the traditional sense, but in how Europe deals with big tech. So stay tuned, let's begin, and have fun. We see you later in the Tech Community Lounge.
Welcome, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. And a special welcome to our guest, Carla Husted from Mercator Stiftung.
Hi, Dale. It's great to be here today.
And Kai Zenner from the European Parliament.
Hi, Dale.
Before we jump in, I think it'd be good to get a personal introduction from each of you, what you're doing, what you're working on, but particularly what brought you to become interested in digital sovereignty and the European identity. If you could start, Carla.
Sure. Thanks for having us. Really looking forward to this conversation. So I'm currently the director at the Center for Digital Society at the Mercator Foundation. The Mercator Foundation is a private philanthropic organization based in Essen, in the center of Germany. And we're active in four different areas, and I'm leading one of those centers. And for the past now almost 5 years, we've been funding projects from academia, think tanks, and civil society on the intersection of the digital transformation and democracy. So today's topic is really at the core of my work. And most of these projects have been like trying to develop solutions around the democratic governance, for example, of social media platforms or the digital transformation of the public sector in Germany, both areas where the dependencies of US hyperscalers are really evident and are increasingly becoming a topic of democracy.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. And look, that's a really nice segue into our next guest, Kai Zenner. And Kai, I guess you've been at the forefront of this issue in terms of how we advocate for independence in Europe around digital sovereignty. Can you tell us more about the work that you do in and around the European Parliament and also with the TUM think tank?
Yes, indeed. We are, similar to Carla, quite long already active in this topic or in this field. I'm now in the parliament for over 8 years, and my boss and I, so MEP Axel Voss, we tried already back in 2017-18 to push a little bit of public discussion about our tech dependencies, about certain risks when it comes to our digital infrastructure and so on. Back then, there was a bit of momentum, but it died down rather quickly. So for Axel and me now, it's of course a really nice development to see that finally our ideas that we have pushed for many, many years becoming more mainstream and are heavily discussed. And maybe just to conclude, besides tech sovereignty, Axel Voss and I were heavily involved in GDPR, so data protection, also the AI Act, and in a lot of other digital policies or pieces of legislation. And similar to tech sovereignty, we always try to accelerate the digital transition across Europe, but without losing our core values that the European Union is standing for.
Fantastic. And look, it's interesting, just pulling in a couple of things you've just said. If you look at the path since 2017, there's been, as you said, that push at the beginning where there was more interest, things died down, and now you can really see a growing tension. I mean, you're getting posts from President Trump saying we have to fight back against the MSA. We have to change all of these laws that are actually what he says are restricting big tech. And on the other side, I can say we Europeans, we value things like privacy and trust, that we value things like being able to trust institutions. This is part of, I guess, the European identity. So I guess to both of you now, a transition to our paper that we're going to talk about. So you've released a paper this year called The European Way, A Blueprint for Reclaiming Our Digital Future. This is from the TUM think tank. Maybe starting with you, Kai, could you say a bit about the TUM think tank and then about what initiated this paper?
Yeah, gladly. So I'm now with the TUM think tank for, I think, almost a year. The Technical University in Munich, as many of the listeners probably know, is one of the leading European and also German universities. And they are actually having now quite interesting master degrees where they are putting technical expertise, but also political studies, legal studies together. And similar to some US universities, they also wanted to, be better able to bring their papers to the attention of policymakers, to start public debates and so on. And how it's so often in life, I run into one of the creators of this think tank at one event in Geneva, I think, AI for Goods, if I'm not mistaken. And we were talking about an opportunity of involving me in the think tank. So it all started. Our project, where Carla was also helping. She can maybe later say a little bit about it. Carla supported us with a lot of really great ideas. The whole idea for this paper, European Way, was a feeling among all those 30, 35 co-authors and all those additional supporters from the outside that we in Europe made a lot of good things in the past when it comes to regulations. So we are standing behind laws like the GDPR, like DMA, DSA, the AI Act. We also support many of the general policy directions. There's something called the digital decade and a declaration of digital principles that Europe is standing for. But our feeling was that despite all those good ideas, implementation was often bad, and often certain concepts or certain terms like European Way, something the Commission was also using in the past frequently, were not really connected with substance. What I mean is that they remained rather buzzwords, and no one really know what exactly the Commission or the European Union really means when they are saying this is the European way to digitize, this is technology according to European values. And here we went in with our paper and based on research, based on experience, we came up with six key principles that we feel Europe digital room or Europe's digital policies are really standing for. And then we also felt that if you come up with those principles, you should implement them in an overall master plan or overall strategy, because also here we felt the European Union is doing a lot of things, but the big issue is that they are often not connected. It's not really coherent. This was then the second part of our paper, where we tried to put everything together and really create an overarching horizontal strategy or vision for Europe.
Fantastic. Thanks for the detailed background. That's really helpful. I think maybe it's worth taking a step back now. And Carla, for us, our audience is often senior leaders in industry and business who are trying to orientate themselves around how they work with technology, how they work with cloud providers, and all different aspects of these big questions, I guess, that we have to make in our daily lives personally, but also in business. Now, you, of course, at the Center for Digital Society, what are the things we need to be aware of if we go to the base levels? What is it we need to be aware of when we're making these decisions about our digital rights? right now, given that we're in this, I guess, high tense geopolitical situation, and the hyperscalers are really demanding a lot from Europe and pushing with every button they can find?
Yeah, that's a big question. Let me start with the situation we're in right now. I think it's about 80% of digital infrastructures that are actually being imported, not coming from within Europe. And this has always been a problem, because if we look at the definition of digital sovereignty, it means that we are able to shape technologies in a way that they represent our own values, that they are compliant with our own laws, that we can prevent lock-in effects, that in moments of outage, we're still able to control it, that we understand how the technology works. So transparency is a key part. And this has always been a problem. Also, 10 years ago, we had a very different geopolitical situation. However, of course, if you have like a really good relationship with the countries where these technologies come from, and most of those technologies that Europe is dependent on are still coming from the US, although China is playing an increasing role. I mean, we were in a really good path. Also, when we look at regulation, the last time I visited the US was before the current Trump presidency, and I was having really good conversations in Washington and California with legislators that were actually looking at Europe and saying, this has been an inspiration. We're working on similar transparency laws or platform governance laws, and particularly in the field of antitrust, which you don't expect from the US, and competition law, we were seeing really great advancements. Now this is completely changed. The dependency is the same, but we're in a situation where the US has still understood the power of these laws, but it's seeing it as a threat. And we're seeing an unprecedented combination, and I think this is what everybody needs to understand in business and politics, of economic power and political power. For a long time, we were saying, okay, it's just about making money, even for social network companies, it's about making money. And if there's harms that come out of these technologies, if we create the right governance, we're going to make it work somehow. But what we're seeing, particularly with people like Elon Musk, is that it's not about just making money, it's about governing the world. There is a really strong, I almost want to call it colonial sentiment to it, and an identity of the strongest, in his definition, most intelligent, deserves to rule the world. And we're seeing how people like him are trying to influence also national European politics. For example, him interfering in German politics by pushing the AfD in many ways that we can see, and probably also ways that we cannot see.
Yeah. It's fascinating, actually. If you talk about it like this, I think there's one aspect, of course, it's about big personalities. This is classic kind of, you know, these huge, big titans of business, and they love to throw their weight around. We see that, you know, I think there was the last string of tweets about the DSA. That was actually coming after a conversation that had taken place. Actually, that was an article that came out in the Handelsblatt. There'd been a meeting beforehand with Mark Zuckerberg and Trump. You know, so this using the president of the United States as an extended wing of lobbying is kind of it's something we never would have imagined, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. But the thing is we've reached this point, and I think maybe there's something even more fundamental, which maybe you can talk to, Carla, is there is a different attitude and value system in the US as in Europe. And there is a feeling, you know, if you're around Silicon Valley, that it is survival of the fittest, that things like people's private data is revenue, that that's a money stream rather than something that should be protected. How do we deal with that in terms of, I know we need to protect our areas as our jurisdiction, but at the same time, there are people in Europe, even in the AI space, that say it's so impossible to build models here because we can't access data like people in the US. And so this becomes an innovation problem. I remember one speaker I spoke to for our tech conference was saying that it's like trying to run down a hill, and in Europe, every 10 meters, you've got to open a gate and close it again. And this is the problem with the complexity of regulation. So how do we make that balance between protecting the rights of citizens, of entities in Europe, but also making sure that we can speak fast enough to be competitive?
Yeah, you're getting right into the current debate, which I find in many ways problematic, of this false dichotomy between regulation and innovation. And I think something that has always in some way united Kai and me and some of the people that have contributed to the paper is that we don't think this is dichotomy that holds in a full sense. And oftentimes when I read articles now about the omnibus and how it applies to digital policy, for example, I find it like kind of intellectually insulting because it's so black and white. And of course, we need to have a discussion of what good regulation looks like. And digital technologies are different than other technologies in many ways. AI systems are different tomorrow than they were yesterday. And what does it mean for like scrutiny and for quality assurances and so on? We need to have this discussion. We also, of course, need to learn from mistakes that were made in the past, for example, with GDPR and the burden they've put on small companies, on startups in Europe. A lot of this, however, has very little to do with the regulation itself and much more to do with how it's being applied. And I think this is where we need to look at. We have very strong instruments, you can almost call it weapons right now, in fighting big tech monopolies with the regulation that we have built. GDPR to start with, but also the newer, I think, really thoughtfully developed ones like the DSA, but also the Digital Market Act, which focuses on market structures. And we need these because what we see right now in markets is a really strong concentration of power also vertically. And if we want European startups to grow, we need to break these vertical integration. And the DMA is giving us new tools to do so. But the problem is oftentimes that there's new regulation, as the ones I just mentioned. And then just 5 minutes later, there's already a new discussion about, oh, did we go too far? Instead of being proud of what we did here and like putting actual resources into doing this right. I think this has been the problem of the past, that we didn't think enough about good implementation of these laws.
I have to put that straight to Kai because it's a bit like bad parenting. Do you know what I mean? It's like the classic thing they teach you. Yeah. I've got two kids, you know. The thing you have to do is be consistent, follow through, don't always backpedal. And for you, Kai, you know, I'm not really deep in this policy side, but I've just seen that there's, in the last few weeks, discussions about loosening the laws around AI access, around algorithmic control. Yeah. This is, I guess, I know there are camps within Brussels as well. How do we make sure that we don't lose what we've been fighting for many years, but also give enough space for that innovation? I've already asked that question, of course, to Carla, but now to you.
No, definitely. So there's definitely the risk of that exactly happening. And I'm completely with Carla. Again, for Axel and me, we are almost now veterans here in Brussels. We saw a lot of up and downs and buzzwords coming and going and so on. And for me, it's also a big pity to see that after years of regulating, let's say, without limits, and which is not in itself a problem, but without coherence, I was talking already about it. Most of the laws were being drafted, negotiated in policy silos. I can speak from my own experience when we in the AI Act, I personally was responsible on a technical level for deep fakes. We wanted to coordinate with our colleagues in DSA and other fields, also data protection. But we were being told by the Commission, by other leading policymakers, we don't have time, it's not necessary, it's too difficult, it's too political. There were always some reasons. And this, of course, led to a situation where many laws were not really fitting well to each other, were creating unclarity due to legal overlaps, clear contradictions. My favorite example is that open source is being defined three times in completely different ways. And all of this, of course, is leading to problems. And Carla was mentioning it rightfully that in particular when it comes to enforcement, a lot of additional mistakes have been done. Member states didn't invest enough in governance structures. There were a lot of different forms of interpretations and so on. So why do I talk so lengthy about all those past mistakes? Because and this brings me again back to TUM think tank, but also a lot of think tanks here in Brussels, like Bruegel, like SEPS, or in Germany, SVP, and so on. We all, so the think tankers, but also many policymakers, we're all saying, okay, look, this is not the right way to go. We need to do better regulation. We need to stick to good governance principles. We need to make sure that the laws that we are creating are really working in practice. And of course, this brings us back to our principles, that we have basically also a united understanding of what those principles are that we are pushing. Unfortunately, after problems occurred, and there was the Draghi report, our economy is declining, there are geopolitical tensions and so on, the tide changed to the other extreme. And now we are not talking about more and more regulation anymore, but we are talking about, okay, let's get rid of everything. As Carla was saying, it's harming innovation. We are going too much into detail. And the funny thing for me is that it's often the same people that a few years ago were all for, let's do another law, let's do another law. And now they are telling us, no, 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 we should deregulate and so on. So what would be the best way out? And you asked it with the last point of your question, would be, again, of course, the middle ground. So we should definitely not throw everything in the bin and deregulate from everything what we have done, because many of those laws had the right intention, had the right policy objectives, had probably even 90% done in a right way, but it's all about the coherence. It's all about making it work in practice. And yeah, I guess both of us, Carla and I, and probably even you, Dale, would love to see this middle ground solution that hopefully politics will find in the end.
Can I jump in here and say something in addition? Amazing. So first of all, I think I might want to highlight one of the things where I see like learning and policymaking from the GDPR in comparison to the newer laws now is, as I mentioned earlier, something that has rightfully been critiqued, is that the impact on smaller businesses of the GDPR has been felt, or in reality been quite large in comparison to the impact on big tech. And what we see now, both in the AI Act and in the DSA in different ways, is like answers to this problem. The AI Act does it through a risk-based regulation. So it defines certain high-risk systems. And the DSA, which I think is the even better solution, does it by defining something that is called VLABs, very large online platforms. So if you have a certain user number, special laws apply. And the regulation for smaller businesses is much, much lower, the burden. And the other thing is that I think I want to highlight something that Kai just said, which is the interaction of those different laws. I think this is a huge challenge in implementation as well. And we're seeing right now that OpenAI is trying the smart shopping option in ChatGPT. So soon, users of ChatGPT will be able to get shopping recommendations by a system that they used before for like casual conversations or, I don't know, summaries of books that they try to read and so on. And this shows that now ChatGPT and this development that we're seeing needs a response that is a combination of the AI Act, the DSA, and the DMA. Mm-hmm. I can go into why and how, but might take too long.
We definitely don't have time for that. But, you know, I want to dig into something here, which underlying this bad parenting thing we talked about making a strong law, rolling it back again. We saw it with the Green Deal. We've seen it with the DSA, DMA. What do you think the effect is here of lobbying? Because my experience, I've been running major events for many years. I always have ministers at my events. And every time I have a hyperscaler at a ministry level event, they ask for private time in a closed room. And often their teams accept it. So you're talking about the people that really decide the future direction of major countries getting time alone with the Googles and the Amazon Web Services of the world. How do we balance that? Because I am sure that there's a mechanism in the background. As soon as a strong regulation comes in place, those machinery go into overdrive. How do we deal with it? Because that's a systemic problem. Carla, you could start.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a power imbalance when it comes to lobbying power, both in Europe, where a lot of big tech companies have focused on, but also on a national level. But I feel that the thing that is even more problematic is actually how they shape the narrative of how we think about innovation and technology. And something that we're seeing is that people who are part of these tech companies building these kind of technologies are often also the ones talking about the substantial long-term risks that come from these technologies, like artificial general intelligence, AI taking over and controlling humans. And I believe that maybe some of them actually believe this is the case, but it's also a tactic of pulling away attention from the harm that they are causing now with their business models. And they're also trying to create this story where they are the only ones who can actually truly create innovation. And the effect I'm seeing from this is that Europe is, despite saying we're going our own path, we're not copying China, we're not copying the US, is then, when you look at what's actually happening, a little bit helplessly stumbling around, and then in some cases actually trying to copy what the US is doing. And I think that's not just problematic from a democratic perspective, it's also like economically very stupid, because we don't have the same resources. A lot of the markets are saturated. And I think Europe really needs to focus on its own strengths, which are very different to the ones of the US.
Fantastic.
Yeah, maybe I can compliment this time, just really to give you a perspective here from within Brussels, because it's quite interesting if you are now speaking with trade associations or also single, rather powerful companies coming from Germany, from Europe, and so on. Actually, they are not pushing for what the commission currently proposed, because in the end, those companies are need of legal certainty. So if they now invested a lot of money in, for example, an Article 9 AI governance system, and well, it's not being done, but imagine now it's being disabled and you don't need to do it anymore. We saw it a bit with the Green Deal. Then all of those investments in the future were for nothing. So what we, however, see here in Brussels, of course, that we have certain voices that are extremely loud, not always representing the biggest players, sometimes, yes, but those loud voices, similar to a lot of problems we have currently in our democratic societies, when it's about fake news and so on and so on, that those loud voices in the end are sometimes convincing the policymakers to go for those extreme solutions. Again, even though I would say the vast majority of especially European companies would not really support it. So yes, then I would, Dale, I would definitely say we have a kind of problem, structural problem here in Brussels and probably also in the member states when it comes to representation and when it comes to access of, in particular, smaller market players to policymakers, because their voice apparently doesn't come through.
Great. And look, we're coming towards the end now, and it'd be good to just get, I guess, a takeaway for our audience. So as I mentioned, people working in manufacturing, in industry, in business, why should we care about this stuff? How does it affect our daily business? What are the risks? Could you take a shot at this, Carla?
I mean, from a business perspective, honestly, it's the dependency can be in economic risks. I mean, we're seeing Microsoft increasing its fees over time. I know the statistics from the public sector, which is highly dependent. I think 96% of German government institutions are using Microsoft. And in the past couple of years, they've increased their fines by, I don't know, 200% or even more. So this is obviously a problem. And then we've also seen, again, in the case of Microsoft, how the International Court of Justice, director, he lost his access to his Outlook email account, got sanctioned by Microsoft, and they're now switching, interestingly, to a German alternative coming right from next to where our foundation is based, Bochum, the Zendes, Open Desk, which interestingly the German government hasn't been able to do so far. So I think it can save costs to switch to European providers where you are more sovereign and the way you govern it. I think it has potential for like personalizing it more for your needs. And it's just a safety thing. And depending on what kind of business you're in, if you're working with end customers, it's going back to how we started. It's about trust. And Germany is a country that's a big difference to the US culturally or also to China, where I just recently did a learning trip. Germans are a little bit hesitant when it comes to new technologies overall. And I think we need to understand that it can become, particularly in B2C or government to citizen relationships, it can really become an advantage if we build technologies in a safe way, in a privacy preserving way, and if we can also, if we're able to communicate this as an advantage. Because a lot of, I think, the long-term profitable business in the AI context also doesn't lie in the large foundation models. It lies in really good industrial applications. And this really fits actually with the German strength and the German history of how we've been successful building high quality automotives or mechanical engineering technology. And those sectors are also have always been defined by quality and trust.
It's a fantastic turn on this because we were talking about efficiency and innovation before and this dichotomy which you rightly challenged around, you know, either has to be regulated or is innovative. And if we look at this on a meta level and say that trust is the foundation of good business, particularly in times where across the Atlantic and the US trust is being undermined at every level, it actually makes us ideal sustainable business partners. So maybe as a final question to you, Kai, what would you say, how do we get started? What's the step? If you want to get engaged with sovereign tech and sovereign data, what do we need to do? What are the first steps for individuals and for business?
Yeah. So in our paper, of course, we were talking a lot about what politics can do, that we need an overarching vision and so on and so on. But actually, those principles that we tabled at the very beginning of our paper is going directly to this direction that Carla was now talking about, because our feeling is indeed, the European industry was always decentralized. You know the cliche, and especially in Germany, we have, 95% SMEs and startups. So if you compare us to other areas of the world, we indeed are in particular good when it comes to the opposite of what some people are calling off-the-shelf products, so horizontal products that are working everywhere, so a typical Microsoft product and so on and so on. We can do niche products. We can do products that are fitting, for example, specific regional requirements, or, for example, create a foundation model that is good in a certain language, something that Mistral, Black Forest Lab, Silo AI, which now part of AMD, is trying. But what we see also in the Emirates and in other areas around the world. And this, indeed, as Carla said, I see as a huge opportunity for our European companies, that they are actually creating something that is unique, that you don't find outside Europe, and where we are in particular qualified to deliver something in the highest quality, where we, however, also by sticking to our core principles, for example, interoperability and so on, not creating just an alternative to some overarching digital services that is dominating everything, but we are really keeping the door open for the cooperation between different technologies, that you can buy services and put them together and so on. And if companies are more and more confident to go this way, we will immediately see, let's say, good effects. And there I would also claim that now with the Digital Serenity Summit that we just saw in Berlin, and Macron and Merz making strong statements in this direction, saying or telling companies that the German state and the French state will support industry going exactly this way that I was talking about. I hope that our companies now can have this confidence, because they know this is something our governments are also thinking quite aligned, and we might even see some support when it comes to public procurement, for example.
Fantastic. You know, it's really interesting. You listen to you speak, it reminds me of a few things. I mean, one is the fact that German's strong economy that grew out of the 60s came from its specialization.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It didn't come from monopolies and huge megaliths, you know? And I think that this is an argument for, I guess, a logical and helpful regulation, because regulation stops monopolies from taking over, which actually stifle innovation in the long term. So that's one aspect. And the interesting second part of it is that if we look at it like that, then we're transporting this epic of what Germany was strong at around the family-owned business centered in values, but in a digital age. So you're offering these surge of services in the digital space. So I think it's a fascinating thought and something, of course, for our listeners, many of whom come or are owners of family-owned business and have been looking at how they can innovate and become digital affine and ready for AI as well. So look, a big thank you to both of you. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thanks very much for being here, and we look forward to seeing you again at Tech 2026, end of May, beginning of June in Heilbronn.
Perfect. Thank you, Dale.
Cheers.
That was Dale talking to Carla and Kai. As always, we'd like to close this podcast with our Tech Lounge segment, where we bring in voices and questions from the community, questions we've gathered ourselves or that were sent to us directly. So the first question, dear Dale, is one just from me, simply listening to your conversation with Carla and Kai just right now. I was asking myself if Europe really wants to parent, that was your metaphor, if he wants to parent big tech better, in a better way. Where do you see consistency being most urgently needed? Is it in regulation, as you talked? Is it in enforcement? Or maybe is it also a matter of political communication? What do you think?
Yeah, I think a key thing we need is we need to make sure there's a dialogue happening. We need a dialogue between those who set regulation and the people who are affected by it, whether it's people in society, but particularly in business. Because in business, if you're not engaging with people that set the regulation, you'll end up finding yourself in a situation where the regulations don't fit the needs for your business profiles. And regulations shouldn't block business processes and needs. They should support. So I think we all need to think about engaging in dialogue. There's lots of avenues which regulators use, particularly at the European level, town hall sessions, feedback, but also just talking about it with other business people and discussing the need for this idea of logical and understandable regulation, because nothing's right the first time, and regulation has to be something which is evolving and growing with time.
Mm. Right. What I also wanted to ask you is a little reflecting of what we both picked up repeatedly from our community voices, also during our Tech Talk sessions with the community, a little looking ahead to the Tech in Heilbronn 2026. We're bringing together European leaders from politics, business and science, as you all know, and you are about to organize that all, so you have a lot of conversations. Is there one uncomfortable question you think that European leaders are still avoiding or is not asked that frequently?
I'm going to throw it in the room. What is your plan for war if war comes to Europe?
Mm-hmm. Right, so a rather tough one, right?
It is a tough one, but I think it's a necessary conversation, because I think right now we're still living in the twilight of an era where business as usual is normal and everything's going to be fine. We hope that we're going to come back towards stability, but there are many signs that we need to ready ourselves for Europe in a war economy. Europe is already at conflict. Conflict, as we know, is a continuum, but we don't want to end up in open conflict. And if that happens, every business needs to be prepared. You need to be thinking about how does your baseline business model ready for the changes that happen to economy and society in a war economy.
All right. Thank you, Dale. So this is something we're going to look deeper into in the next conversations. Thank you much for your time today and looking forward to our next meeting. Thanks, Dale. That's it for today. Thank you very much for joining us on The Optimist. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love your feedback on Spotify or on whichever platform you're listening to from. You can also reach us anytime at hello@tech-europe.org. See you next time and stay optimistic.
Thanks for listening to The Optimist. For more insights and updates about tech, visit us at tech-europe.org. theoptimist.org. The Optimist is produced by Tech by Handelsblatt. Music by Christian Heinemann. Stay curious.